in the heart of the castle-like ville of Front Royal, Ryan and his friends found that the day passed with infinite slowness. They had been taken away by the sec patrols, along winding passages, up and down narrow stone staircases, to what Ryan thought must be the third or fourth floor of the fortress. Each of them was pushed firmly into separate rooms, the doors slamming shut behind them, keys grating in locks. To his amazement, Ryan found that he was in a chamber that had once been his nursery. The pictures on the walls of stags and boars being torn apart by ferocious hounds were gone, and the draperies were now of plain blue material. The window, which was barred, looked out over the scum-covered moat, across the strip of cleared land, to the rolling waves of the forest ocean. Shelves, mainly empty, lined the wall that had once held Ryan's toys and the handed-down model blasters and soldiers of his two older brothers. Morgan's toys had been well used but serviceable. Harvey's had been generally in mint condition, but with sly damage, a leg severed from a soldier, or a wing cut through on a USAF F-4C Phantom. There had been something about the shelves, something that Morgan had once shown him. There was some way to get behind it, into the room next along the corridor, which had once been used by an earlier Baron for his illicit affairs with serving maids. There had been a simple catch, Ryan remembered, but it had been too high and too stiff for him to reach easily. There was a sliding panel in the center of the heavy oak door, and as Ryan glanced at it, the square moved back silently. An eye appeared briefly, staring in at him. Then the eye was gone, and Ryan thought he glimpsed the violet flash of an amethyst before the panel closed. If there was a hidden doorway between his room and the next one, it was dangerous to try to find it with someone manning the spy hole. Ryan went back to the window, looking out toward the west, over the blue haze of the distant mountains. He knew Jack Lauren was in the first room along the corridor, and he thought Christie had been put in the chamber on his right, the chamber that he remembered had the connecting door. It was a possibility worth hanging on to. Several times during the afternoon, he saw or heard someone watching him. There was a rainstorm at 4 o'clock. He could hear a bell chiming the hour from the central tower of the ville, a sound that once again plunged his mind back 20 years to his childhood. He remembered standing in this very room, staring out through the window, before it was barred, watching a bald eagle with a monstrous wingspan of more than 20 feet pluck a young foal from the meadow and carry it off, whinnying. The mare had run below in hopeless, desperate circles. His thoughts went to Doc and Lori, out there in the sheeting rain that came slanting in gray clouds from the west. The trails were so complex that he feared they would have become lost, though the girl sometimes displayed an uncanny sense of direction. And there was also the hope that Nathan Freeman would have been able to find them and lead them to the wag. But what could they do against the massively invulnerable pile of stones that was the Ville of Front Royal?
Not much.
Just before 5, a tray was brought in by a young man with hard eyes and the kind of formal clothes that a sec man wears when he wants you to know he's a sec man. There was a cup of milk on the tray and some biscuits.
Baron and Lady Rachel eat at 6. You'll be ready.
I'm not going anywhere.
No, you're not.
The sec man backed away to the door, shut it firmly, and turned the key in the lock. Through the brief gap, Ryan noticed a pair of crimson-uniformed sec guards with their M16 carbines carried at port arms. Despite his gross personal appearance, Baron Harvey ran a tight ville. Or Lady Rachel did. There was another flurry of a storm around 5:30, with surging clouds of dark green and purple skating across the pale blue sky. Lightning crackled through the dark chem clouds, throwing violent shadows across the room where Ryan waited patiently. The door opened at 5 to 6. Christie smiled at him from the corridor.
Don't know about you, lover, but I could eat me a muty buffalo, horns and all.
You got a pretty mouth, lady. Shut it or lose it.
The eyes of the sergeant who'd brought them in from Shearsville met Ryan's stare, and he came close to a smile.
You another one wants to try me, one eye?
I'd kill you.
You think?
I know. You're big and strong, but you're also soft. You've gotten used to breaking the arms of women and kids.
If the Baron says what he usually says, we'll have a chance to see if you're right, one eye.
I'll wait.
Threats are cheap.
Not a threat. It's a promise. One day you'll learn the difference.
JB and Jack joined them in the passage, each with a trio of guards at the shoulder. JB made the fortress clothes look like a neat military uniform. The albino boy had already ripped the sleeves out of his jerkin and wore the breeches low on the hip to give himself greater freedom of movement.
This way!
They ate in what had always been the old banqueting hall of the Ville. Ryan's father had told him that the region around Front Royal had mainly been hit by missiles that killed but didn't destroy. Ryan later came to understand that the missiles had been neutron bombs. It explained why the Ville itself was in such remarkable condition for a pre-winter building. The table was the same. Hewn from two pieces of an enormous oak tree, it had been sliced through and joined to give room to seat at least 20 aside. The four guests sat together, Ryan and Jack opposite Christy and the armorer, at the far end of the table, farthest away from the log fire that crackled and spat brightly and noisily. Sekhmen, as silent as statues, stood at regular intervals around the perimeter of the hall, and more watched from the gallery on the second floor. The light came from a dozen multi-branched candelabra on the table and burning torches spaced along the four walls of the room.
No electricity. Must have.
Yeah. Most is wind or water generated. Storage batteries in the cellars. Always been a tradition here at the Ville to use candles and lamps and torches like those.
Stand for Lord Harvey Carter, Baron of Front Royal, and his wife, the Lady Rachel.
The four friends stood up, chairs scraping on the rush-covered stone floor. In the brighter light of the Great Hall, Harvey Carter was even more grotesque than at first sight. Ryan upped his guesstimate of his brother's weight to 400 pounds, contained in a billowing coat with horn buttons. It was a dark maroon color, and seemed to have used up enough material to make a fair-sized tent. The clothes were designed to try to minimize his deformities, but nothing could conceal the crooked back or the dragging leg. The wide belt of polished snakeskin held two small holsters with the gleaming butts of twin Colt pistols peeking from them. Harvey took a reinforced carving chair at the head of the long table, waving a hand to his wife to sit on his right side. Rachel Carter was in her middle 30s, and it looked as though she worked hard to keep her appearance down in the 20s. The reward was that in the half-light of the big chamber, she could pass for 29. Maybe. Her black hair supported a narrow silver coronet that sparkled with diamonds. The piece was a Carter heirloom, and Ryan felt a flush of surprising anger at seeing the murderous slut flaunting it. Her dress was a blue velvet so deep that it could be taken for black. A silver brooch, shaped like a long-necked flamingo, its tail a mass of different colored precious stones, decorated the low front. She nodded to Ryan and his friends, totally ignoring her husband. On her arm was a small purse of scuffed black leather, at odds with the rest of her immaculate appearance. The chair to the left of the Baron remained empty. Harvey got an almost imperceptible shake of the head from his wife.
Ah, no matter. Matter is energy, is mass and matter. Doesn't matter to me. No damn matter.
Once they had both seated themselves, Ryan and his three friends also sat down. The table was so long that they were 20 yards away from Rachel and the Baron. Harvey clapped his hands, and servants, dressed in the livery of the Ville, appeared bearing platters and tureens and great serving dishes. Ryan had somehow expected it would be the same blue dinner service with the willow pattern design that he'd eaten from during his childhood. As the meal began, he realized why that no longer existed. The Baron Carter was an intemperate and violently clumsy eater. There was no sequence of courses, such as soup followed by fish, followed by game, followed by salad, followed by a main course of meat, with desserts and then cheese and fruit. Everything came at once. The servants lined up at the far end of the table while their lord and master ladled out slopping portions of anything that caught his eye. He piled it all into a bowl in front of him that must have been able to hold 5 gallons of liquid or 30 pounds of solid food. At that distance, it was difficult for them to see what precisely went into the bowl, but the servants eventually made their way to the guests' end of the table. Lady Rachel only indicated a small portion of steamed fish for herself, with a spoonful of sugar peas. She took only water to drink. Ryan had rarely seen a more spectacular array of food. There was steak and great hunks of horse meat, marinated in white port wine, lamb cutlets with a red fruit sauce, pork over fat, smothered in honey and wild ginger, flounders served with toasted almonds, bowls of shrimps wallowing in a pepper sauce and crabs still in their shells. Meat that Christy identified as turkey, pallid and waxen, dripping with melted goat's cheese and crushed peppercorns, tomatoes and onions in sour cream, sprinkled with mushrooms and little green berries, a thick gray-brown soup that had unnervingly dozens of hard-boiled eggs bobbing greasily around in it, potatoes and rutabagas and beans, minced and fried in gravy. There were also bowls of fruit, cooked and raw, mostly in sweet and sickly sauces that drenched them. There was water to drink, or a thick lilac-colored liqueur that had an unusual taste.
Like something a gaudy whore would bathe in.
J.B. struggled to conceal his disgust at the scented flavor, opting for the water instead. He followed Rachel Carter's example and took only a portion of boiled fish and a side helping of vegetables. Ryan chose a steak, finding it grievously underdone, blood seeping from the meat before he even laid a knife into it. He ladled some fried beans on the side and discovered they'd been soaked with grated red chilies that almost took the skin off his tongue. Christy contented herself with a chipped goblet of spring water and some of the potatoes, which had been fried in butter. She also took a couple of slices of the whole wheat bread from the wooden board, which was carried by an elderly man with trembling hands, who kept his head bowed and didn't look at any of the guests. With a shudder, Christy noticed that the old servant's hands had been branded several times, and his fingers and knuckles showed the unmistakable signs of having been brutally broken more than once.
Is the food good, Brother Thursby?
Harvey Carter's face and beardless chins were beslobbered with runnels of grease, carrying particles of several different courses of the meal. His piggy little eyes had almost vanished behind rolls of fat.
Yeah, Baron Carter.
Shit. Eating better from a double-paw swampy's chuck-out pile.
What did the whitehead say?
Rachel Carter's blazing eyes focused on Ryan.
Good food, my lady.
I have lost the taste for food, Master Thursby. I no longer get any pleasure from the act of eating.
Her hands folded over each other, fingers writhing like 10 white snakes. As they watched, ignoring the grunting and wallowing of Harvey Carter, the woman fumbled in her black purse and took out a circular mirror with an ornately sculpted edge where tiny dragons fought amid a tangled forest. It was another of the Carter heirlooms. She also removed a small sliver of polished steel and a tiny brown vial, which was tightly corked.
Jolt.
But Ryan had already recognized what was happening. The woman was probably addicted to the hallucinogenic mix of coke and mescaline. Not everyone who took Jolt became quickly addicted, but once you were well hooked, then you were on a steep and icy slope that carried you down faster.